Hi, this is James Van Osdell, and by now you've heard me talk about my friends at Suburban Roofing and Siding. If you own a home, well, it's officially spring as I'm recording this. Winter's over. Now's the time to take that look outside, see how your roof and siding and gutters are looking after the elements did their thing over the past few months. Talk to my guys before you talk to anyone else. Talk to them before you talk to the insurance company. You can trust their staff with more than 40 years of collective experience. Suburban Roofing and Siding. Roofing, siding, windows, gutters, they do it all. Call 224-677-6149, 224-677-6149, or visit them on the World Wide Web. So much you can do there. SuburbanRoofingAndSiding.com. Car Con Carne is also sponsored by a book, 90 Days in the 90s, written by my friend Andy Fry. I just mentioned that it's officially spring. Great time to crack open a new book. Now, I'm recording this over by Avondale-ish, maybe? The point is, I am in the heart of the north side of Chicago, and the north side of Chicago is where a lot of this book takes place, only in the 1990s. See, the deal is, Darby owns a record store in 90 Days in the 90s, and she discovers the Gray Line, which is a CTA line that takes her back in time to the 90s in Chicago. Pretty cool idea. There are times when I think, oh, I wish I could go back there. Well, you can, vicariously, through Darby in this book, 90 Days in the 90s. If you lived through it or are fascinated by that era, that really wonderful era for music and pop culture, grab a copy of the book. You can get one on Amazon or just go to Andy's website, 90daysinthe90s.com.
It's Car Con Carne. Let's eat in the car. And now here's the star of our show, James Van Osdell.
The Academy is giving us one more weekend, or at least a day, June 21st, opening up for Fall Out Boy on the tour that lands at Wrigley Field, just as summer's kicking into high gear. Tonight, right now, whenever you're watching this, we're getting down to Siskey Business. Adam T. Siska, bassist of the returning heroes, the Academy is here. We have dumplings. We're by Jungbu over by Kimball and the Expressway. This is one of the great secrets of Chicago, this location right here.
It is, and I live like just on the other side of the expressway here. It's easier for me to walk than to drive here because of this parking lot. I don't know if you guys have been to Jungbu Market, Jungbu. I'm not even sure how you say the name of this place, but it's the parking lot is a hellhole.
It's a little active.
Because of people getting on and off the highway in either direction.
We're staring at the exit ramp of the expressway right here.
I walk by here and I see a lot of near misses constantly. So, James, good luck getting out of here.
Thank you. All right, so before we get to the dumplings, I'm going to ask the obvious question. Riot Fest in the fall.
Yep.
Fall Out Boy happening this summer. You got that Vegas festival thing happening in October. What does this all mean?
It's hard to say. You know, we weren't really saying yes to anything. You know, we had gotten a couple offers like in 2019 to do things in 2020, and we all know how that panned out. So we actually felt really fortunate that we had kind of decided not to do anything at that point, just because planning something and then canceling would be really upsetting to a band that hasn't done anything in several years, you know. So we were at a place where we were like, I don't know if we'll ever play again. And then sometime last, maybe April, I was over here. I got a massage in Wicker Park, and I was kind of in that post-massage daze.
You were blissed out?
Yeah, I was completely blissed out, and I walked out, and I had a text message from one of the guys who books Riot Fest, and it said, just wanted to connect with you if you could give me a call. And within the next 5 minutes, like, we pretty much confirmed Riot Fest.
Easy? Just like, will you do this? Okay.
Yeah, it was like, would you be interested in reuniting for Riot Fest? And I was kind of like, yeah, we would. You know, you caught me at a really good time. I'm in a great mood. And, you know, there were some other things that I had to, you know, basically I had to pass someone else's information along to, you know, really make the proper booking, you know, but it just felt right. You know, I think after sitting at home for a couple of years, I think everyone in our band felt ready to you know, it takes a lot when we haven't played in 7 years. You know, we were always a band that it matters to us how we sound, mm-hmm. you know, so that was probably the most nerve-wracking part of it, is like, can we still do it? You know, the Butcher, our drummer, does he still play the drums? That was like a big question. The answer was kind of like, not really. And I was like, okay, great. Well, you have like, you know, 4 to 6 months, however mm-hmm. long it was, start practicing. And that kind of went for all of us. And, you know, I was kind of the only one that was like, had been gigging like pretty regularly since the band, you know, so... but it came together. We actually put in a lot of rehearsal time before Riot Fest. And you know, for us, that's actually our favorite part, is getting in and kind of like, you know, when you think about our music, you know, I was a young teenager. I mean, I was 15 when we wrote the first album. It's a little weird to step into those shoes sure. sometimes. So we always
it probably feels it, like a lifetime ago.
It does. And we actually have a song called Lifetime. So we played that one. It's been a lifetime. But it does. And I think for us, rehearsal is about finding a way to make something old feel like we can connect with it, with where we're at now. And, I don't think we've ever played better than we did at the two shows.
That feels good.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to say that, because we didn't know how it was going to go.
And the Butcher brought it.
He did. The first couple days of rehearsal, I had to like whip him into shape a little bit, you know. You know what I'm talking about, Butcher. But when showtime came, I mean, I couldn't be happier to have anyone else back there. So it was great.
Let's talk food, because I'm starving. Yep. Are you starving?
I am. I'm always hungry.
Can we show off?
Yeah, we've got some dumplings here. James texted me when he was on his way here.
I'm going to take one.
Kind of talk about the selection. I said anything that doesn't have kimchi. Mm.
We agree on that. Oh, this is already a mess.
Oh, my God. Mine fell apart, uh-huh. but it's excellent. Kimchi is one of the only things.
Because it's something I think you have to grow up with it. I think culturally you have to grow up with kimchi.
It's like Vegemite for Australians. It's terrible to everyone else.
Yeah, I can't eat it. I can't. The smell, it's that fermented smell. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's fermented is one of the few like dirty words for me when it comes to mm-hmm. food. I don't really care much for, you know, the. Like a sweet pickle. What do they call those even?
A gherkin?
Yeah, exactly. I can do that. Like, but pickled food and fermented food is not so much. My wife's vegan and she's really into gut health and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so much on that train.
I have a trail of pork and shredded vegetables already, mm-hmm. like on my person, on my on my interview
these
notes.
These are great.
These are so good.
I live so close and I never come here. I go to the market for groceries, but never hit the dumplings outside.
It's one of the best deals in town. Mm. I got those 6 dumplings, a soda for me, and a water for you for like $7.
I will be here multiple times a week moving forward.
That's what I'm saying. This is one of Chicago's best kept secrets. Yeah, best absolutely. Kept secrets. This is... There are always people outside the dumpling stand. I think they serve until like 7:30 at night. There's a restaurant inside, like a counter service restaurant, which is also really good. And you can eat like a king for not a lot of money.
Yeah, and I'm going in, after we get out of the car, I'm going in to get some mochi.
Ooh, I love mochi.
That's my cat's name. I named it after the mochi that
that's
I bought.
That's a dessert favorite.
So, yeah, it's incredible.
I'm taking one more because I just want to be a mess. It's already coming apart as I'm grabbing it. Oh, my God. So, I mean, you said it. It's been a bit. Last album, 15 years ago.
Crazy.
I know you're sitting on some stuff. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, are you inspired? Have you been inspired to create more together as the Academy is?
Yes. We've been inspired, but we go back and forth a lot on what that would mean. And... You know, it's tough for us. You know, I see bands that kind of come back to play shows and they put out new albums, and I don't want to insult any of them, and I don't mean anyone specifically, but I think the fear is that you put out something that doesn't live up to the legacy or the memory that people have. It's not even about whether it's good, that's so subjective, but I think putting out new music could actually be the way to kill a really good memory. You know, so
I get it. I've seen it work tricky. Both ways, but I get it.
It's tricky, and it's one of the things that, you know, led to, I think, our demise as a band the first time around is, you know, we have differing ideas of, you know, what the band should be, what we want it to be, you know. We all have eclectic taste, you know, but that being said, you know, I think the big thing for us is coming together. And when we get in the room and we rehearse and we went and played those shows, I think there was a feeling all around of, why are we stopping here?
Yeah, how could you not feel that?
Yeah, and then, you know, now we're going to the UK in May, and it's like just enough time for us to like completely get lousy again. So now we have to get back in and really drill it again. And it'll be easier this time than, you know, a 7-year break. And to a certain extent, I think it takes us maybe like, the first time we play a song we haven't played in 7 years, it's terrible. The second time, it's okay. The third time, it's pretty good, you know. And then after that, you know, we drill a lot. We get to where we want it to be. And there reaches a point, actually, where if we kept practicing, it would start to get worse.
Yeah, you hit that point of diminishing returns. Yeah, like
absolutely. So I think we got about there just prior to those shows. And then it was fun because I felt like we stopped at the right moment, went and played, and like it was a complete celebration. I mean, there's always the feeling of like, do people remember us? Do they care? I know we're booked here. You know, we had a really great slot. You know, top line billing under the headliners for Riot Fest, and you know, that was, you know, a huge part of what lured us out of retirement was, you know, to have an opportunity like that here in Chicago, with, in my opinion, the greatest music festival.
You'll get no argument from me.
I don't want to say in the world, you know. I know like there's some pretty prestigious festivals in England, you know, Glastonbury and stuff like that, but Riot Fest is absolutely the best US music festival, and it's not even close for me. It's probably the only one I would actually want to go out to as a fan.
Exactly.
So, feel free to book us at anything else, though. I didn't mean to insult you. But.
Are you able to look back on the past and whatever differences those are? Are you doing it with more clear heads and a greater maturity? Not just you, but the entire band?
Of course. I mean, we're all, mostly all of us are dads now. That changes everything. Just time. You know, I think we've always kind of dealt with each other with a mixture of animosity and humor. You know, like I've always kind of thought a band,
I think that's the definition of passive aggressive.
Yeah, that's always been it. You know, we still, we'll get into it. You know, Mike and I, the guitar player, like, we talk every day, even when the band's not reuniting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years in between the bands, we still had a good, you know, 20-minute to an hour phone call most days of the week, whether we're, you know, a lot of it's not about the band. You know, we talk about every topic. I mean, I think if him and I should have a podcast that's just our phone calls, because there's a lot of banter, you know.
If you need help getting set up,
that would be great. That's probably the only thing holding us back, is knowing where to begin with that. But we actually bicker more than anyone does, but I think it's because we have kind of maintained that brotherhood, whereas, like, I think when the band kind of, when we get active and then we become inactive again, I think some of us don't talk all the time, so you start to miss each other, and there's a little bit of just a respect that grows of, I can't believe I'm even in the room with this guy. I don't want to blow it and bring up something old that, with him and I, it's like maybe even awkward for the other guys in the band sometimes, but we'll just like lay into each other about the band, you know, like, this needs to sound better. We need to do this right, you know, and to us, that's one of my favorite parts, is actually having like a counterpart that like really cares as much as I do about, and that goes for everybody, but
sure,
him and I really, we butt heads, but it's all for the greater good.
I mean, toward the end, first time around, you basically weren't even talking toward the end.
I mean, you know, we made the mistake, you know, I'm sure some other bands make this mistake, but, you know, we made some money and we all kind of retreated into our corners with our own lives. And over time, it became harder to get us in the same room. You know, some of us were living here. Some of us were living in L.A. I was living up in Vermont. You know, it was... It took a lot to get me out of the mountains of Vermont, you know. And we just kind of wouldn't keep in great touch. There wasn't always great dialogue. I think it's like, you know, you got to water those plants, you know, when you have... It's just like any relationship, you know, it really takes communication. And, yeah, I think we were burnt out. You know, the first, like, 5 years we were a band, we were very, very active.
Sure.
We played so many shows. We were always either on tour or in the studio. And then I think at a certain point we were like, well, you know, we'd rather be hanging out with girlfriends or whatever than, you know, dealing with each other's, you know, crap. So it's tough.
But here you are.
Here we are, yeah, and it's incredible to me that, you know, we still have an audience, and I think that's what really that's the, you know, the tie that binds. It's like we can not do anything and then, like, step on stage and there's, like, a certain magic that occurs that isn't there when we do things. You know, I'm playing in a new local band. It's like, you know, the Academy is fans aren't just showing up. It's not a built-in audience for me. You know, it's, I think about, like, you know, Keith Richards, what was the thing he did? Steel Wheels or whatever?
That was, like, a Rolling Stones album, 1989.
Yeah, Steel is...
But he had two solo albums. He did Talk Is Cheap and...
He had the reggae band too, right? What was... He had like a reggae band at some point. I'm trying to remember the name of it even.
But the point is, even like Keith splinters off from Rolling Stones, you...
Right, you know, you know, there's a lot of Smashing Pumpkins fans. People don't often come up talking about Zwan. You know,
or the James Iha solo album from 1988.
When I Come Down.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'll talk about that. Okay. Yeah. I liked that record.
My hands are filthy. I want to say it. I'm not going to say it.
What's that?
I've got a big mess on my hands.
Okay, great.
I've been biting my tongue, but truly I've got like oil and...
He's got a big mess on his hands.
I can't. You're a dad now. You can appreciate it.
Of course I can. we have a habit in our band when we make set lists and when we like have dialogue about what we're going to play, where we come up with like the raunchiest possible alternate song mm-hmm. titles, which obviously for that one we won't even get into it, you know, but it's not appropriate for a dad to talk about these things, but...
Can we talk about it after we're done recording?
Absolutely.
Okay, that would make me happy. You talked about the fans and how, you know, they're still there and they still connect to that music. Let's talk about that period, which seems only appropriate as you're going out with Fall Out Boy.
Yeah.
That was a whole moment in time.
It was.
That was the thing. Can you talk a little bit about it? Because I know you've been nostalgic. You've been sharing pictures from mm-hmm. old shows back in the day. Clearly that still strikes a chord for you just as it does with the fans.
It does. I mean, I think there's something about... It's kind of what I touched on before about making new music. It's like, I'd love to be a band that is not nostalgic. You know, I think that my favorite bands aren't. You know, I think there's always an element of, like, let's be moving forward. Let's mm-hmm. always push the boundaries. But we're not a band anymore, you know? And it gets tricky... Where, you know, we broke up right around the time Instagram came out. Maybe even, like, right before. So when we came back to reunite, there was kind of an element of how do we engage with our audience? We don't really have an Instagram.
Right.
You know, like, we don't... I think, if anything, we've missed out on offers and tours and things like that because people look and they go, oh, well, they don't have any followers, you know? And it's like,
that's
well, we just
so
don't have any content.
Yeah. And, you kicked ass on MySpace.
We were the kings of content back in the day. You know, we, you know, unfortunately there's no quantifiable like metric to gauge this, you know, but we really wrote the blueprint of sorts for the way that webisodes are created and given out to their fans. I mean, we, like, it wasn't pre-YouTube, but it was before YouTube was really just like...
It was before everyone used video.
Exactly. And so we came up with the idea that you would go to our website and it would just be a picture of an old tube television. And if you clicked on the TV, there would be a weekly episode, just kind of like a tour journal, stupid skits. You know, it was really just entertaining us on the road. I mean, people always ask, you know, what was it like? And I would never say it's boring because it was, I mean, I loved every second of it, but it's a lot of monotonous waiting around. You know, it's like, there's a reason why alcoholism and drug abuse is so prevalent in music. It's because there's nothing to do, and you start it's to actually, occupy your brain, I think, and
there's nothing to do, and there's all that adrenaline before and after.
Yeah,
the 1 or 2 hour moments you have.
I think perform. Until I was like, until the band ended, you know, my regular bedtime was like anywhere between 4 and 6 a.m. And that was not, you know, drug or alcohol. Maybe, I drank some beers, but it wasn't like a debaucherous 6 a.m. It was just, it's hard to go to sleep after a show like that. You know, in recent years, I was touring, you know, with Carly Rae Jepsen, the pop singer, and her band, you know, they're very professional, good guys. You know, like, we always knew how to have a good time, but there was a certain line drawn. And her guitar player would, like, we'd play the show, and then he'd brush his teeth and get into bed. Not every night, you know, but I would just be amazed at how that's even done.
Yeah, that's incredible discipline.
Yeah, you know, he would get in there. Maybe he'd be on his computer building tracks and doing something really productive or something, but not me, you know. And you know, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 6 years, but I still, when I go on the road, I stay up all night. If there's a parking lot and a group of people to stand in a circle with and talk to, I mean, that's sign me up, you know.
And now, of course, when you're not performing, when you're at home, if you get to the point where it's like 2 or 3 a.m., do you say, oh, my God, my day's ruined. What am I doing here?
I would say 11 p.m. is, you know. I mean, for me these days, it's the baby goes to sleep at like 7:30, and it's whatever I want to do then, that's on me, because at some point, I'm not going to have a choice about the sleep, you know. So we've kind of gotten in the habit of maybe going to bed at like 8, you know, and just taking what we can get. But I know you asked before about the local scene and coming up, you know, with Fall Out Boy and that whole scene. I mean, that was sort of the launch pad for me into music, was specifically them.
Specifically Fall Out Boy.
Yeah. They, you know, I wouldn't say it all began with them. You know, it really began, what years were you at Q101?
I was there 93 to 2000. 2005 to 2006 and 2008 through 2011.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah. So I'm from the Virgin Islands originally, and I mostly listened to like Caribbean music mixed in with like, I guess, stuff that would have been played on like XRT. You know, my parents were huge Neil Young fans, Hendrix, like Buffalo Springfield, that sort of like fringe jacket 60s, the Birds,
fringe,
you know,
jacket, yeah, for sure.
That was like my household, mixed with like Caribbean music, a lot of reggae and steel drum. And I came to the States in 94. I was taking an airbrush class at the Flatiron Arts Building, and there was some really like grunge looking people outside. And this might have been 93, like, right, it was 93 when I came to the city. And I like peripherally like came across the Pumpkins playing at the Double Door around Siamese Dream's release.
Wow.
And I thought the name was kind of funny. And so I got the record at the Virgin Megastore downtown, and
I forgot there was one downtown too.
Yeah, the one downtown, and I think having listened to like Axis Bold as Love with my parents, the Hendrix album, Siamese Dream had elements of that plus something that was like the beginning of like the rebel from what your parents are into and find your own way. And so Siamese Dream was it for me. And then, you know, I actually didn't discover Q101 at that time. I moved to the suburbs, and there was this kid, Harrison Hickok. I met him on the school playground. He lived in the neighborhood, and we would listen to you and Tim Virgin, and everything revolved around Q101 from then on out. I mean, we would just sit in his room, and we would make up these imaginary bands. That's and we would draw logos, and we would just have a cassette tape and listen to, I mean, we died by like top five of five.
That's hilarious. I mean,
that was everything. And I was in elementary school, you know, like, but I can specifically remember, and you know, I'll kind of date myself just how young, now I'm not young anymore, but you know, at the time, I was going to like Pee Wee football practice and I would be late because I had to hear what was number one. And at the time that I can specifically remember in my head, it was Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
Amazing. Amazing.
So, and it was like we had to hear at least a verse and a chorus of Pretty Fly for a White Guy before we could get out of the car and go to football practice.
That's so, half the song by the time you get there.
I mean, hey, you know, I can vividly, like, I have a vivid memory of like of the top five at five and listening to it. And then shortly after, it was like top nine at nine. Mm-hmm. And that I would be at home with like the leftover McFlurry from the way home from football practice with the cassette tape recording. Like I remember the debut of The Everlasting Gaze.
Uh-huh.
I was getting a foot surgery. The song debuted. I was in the parking lot about to go into surgery and like was late because I had to hear the debut of The Everlasting Gaze.
That's amazing.
Which by the way was a one listen for me. Like by the end of that bridge of The Everlasting Gaze, I was like, this is incredible.
What's interesting, hearing you talk about your background, the Academy has such a smart pop sense to it. You came at it from a different way from a traditional Midwestern independent rock band.
Yep.
I mean, there's like a pop rock script that a lot of bands follow. You went at it from a totally different direction.
Yeah, you know, we were different than those bands that, you know, unfortunately when you ride the wave of like a scene, I think to the average listener who's maybe not super dialed into that, there's always the thing that all the bands sound the same. And I think there were, you know, not to name any names, some bands that did have very similar sounds.
Sure.
But you know, like my mom thinks we sounded just like Fall Out Boy. I don't really think we sounded that much like them, you know. Like,
I think you both share a sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah. I think they had more humor. I think our debut album didn't have too much humor. You know, we were desperate to get out. You know, I mean, so between that era where I was listening to Q101 and when it all kind of started for me, you know, it was Q101 was just everything, and then the Pumpkins broke up. New metal came, and I had a brief moment with some of that. I kind of gravitated more towards like Incubus, Make Yourself,
sure,
than like the, you know, I know they had a DJ, which was pretty stylistically like off kilter for me. But I thought their message and their whole vibe was, you know, from a kid coming from the Caribbean, you know, I liked that they kind of had this like Carlos Castaneda's like didgeridoo,
totally
peyote vibe, and I was taken by it. That and Deftones, sure. And you know, that sort of like,
can we all agree Deftones have held up better than anyone would have predicted back in the day?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that they have a sound that is very you know, like Change in the House of Flies or whatever. That's just a cool song, you know. I mean, that is
a like a muddy and unsettling song.
Yeah, it's like the eeriness of those verses. I mean, I think it's super cool. I mean, I remember going to one of the Twisted shows and seeing them when White Pony came out.
Yeah,
it was a little later on. My first real alternative concert was Twisted Five. I was telling these kids I'm playing with about the lineup.
These kids.
They were blown away by, I was like,
was that The Cure? No.
No. So it was Soul Coughing.
Yes.
Cake.
Yep.
Everlast. Garbage.
Yep.
Beck. Did I say that already? Third Eye Blind. Goo Goo Dolls.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it was stacked with like everyone who was.
I used to love those shows where the bands didn't all make sense on paper. Mm-hmm. And that's to me, I love seeing shows where it's not the same sound from start to finish.
Yep.
That's where I think some promoters and concert bookers get it wrong. Like, I don't want 3 hours of the same vibe.
Yeah.
Like, give me something to look forward to. Don't fatigue me of what I'm getting from the headliner by the time the headliner takes the stage.
I thought that's what was so cool about alternative music, mm-hmm. and Q101 particularly, is there was a very eclectic pool. I mean, the band that, like, outside of the Pumpkins, the band that really, like, I identify with as, like, my, like, when I really found Q101, my buddy had the Sublime self-titled album, and, you know, coming from the Caribbean, it was like, okay, like, this kind of has, it's, you know, I didn't know ska bands at that point, so hearing What I've Got, and, like, specifically Wrong Way, as, like, a fourth grader, hearing those lyrics was, like,
yeah.
I mean, it was everything, you know. It was very, very raunchy, but melodic and cool and really musical.
I remember the first million times I played it on the radio. My only complaint with that, I wish it was, like, 90 seconds longer.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, 2 minutes long. I always wanted just a little bit more.
I will say, the band I'm playing in now, I think it's hard to find a song that passes 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Like, we could play, like, 10 songs in a half hour set.
You're efficient.
You know? Yeah, it's kind of the new thing. You know, we played a show a couple months ago. There was three bands, all had, like, half hour sets where they played, like, a full album. You know?
That's fantastic.
Like, holy shit. But, you know, I told this kid, I'm like, write a bridge, and he doesn't. So, and I still like the songs, and it's kind of cool. They don't feel that short because they're still good. But I've always liked long songs. I think my favorite song is probably, like, Mayonnaise by the Pumpkins, you know, with that.
Classic.
It takes a while to start singing.
I love those slow builds.
Oh, it's incredible.
Well, like Rhinoceros. I mean, they're really good at that stuff.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I get the sense, and I'm going to steal this term from my pal Scott Lucas, I get the sense you're a lifer. Like, no matter what, you're always going to be making music around music. This is who you are.
I thought I was out. You know, when COVID came, I really hung it up. I got a job in tech sales and in manufacturing. I like it. You know, I'm not doing that right now, but I will probably go back to that industry. I really like manufacturing. I love the steady paycheck.
Yeah.
I love the benefits for my wife and family, my daughter. There's so much about it that I love more than the music business. I'm challenged by it in a way that, you know, music is pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And there's a feeling of lightning doesn't strike the same place twice, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I can't believe how lucky I was to have a career in music, because I was marginally talented at the time that, you know, I had to work to catch up to the opportunity, you know. So, you know, I was so...
Are you saying you were faking it till you made it?
100%. For years, too. You know, it wasn't probably until the Academy Years was over that I, like, kind of learned to play the bass.
Oh, wait, I got this figured out.
Yeah.
We're done now. Okay.
Which is fun when we reunite. I feel like I have actually more of a voice musically and that feels really satisfying, you know. But I really just was such a fan of music, and I started going to shows, starting at Twisted Five and the Pumpkins, and, you know, just started going to concerts all the time. And then I met Bill Beckett, who later would become the singer of Academy, but he played drums in my older brother's basement punk rock band. And my brother's taste of punk rock was, like, SR-71 and whatever was on Q101.
Yeah.
You know, it was, like, mainstream. And then Bill Beckett brought in Asian Man Records and Alkaline Trio and the Lawrence Arms and just some really left-of-center stuff, Saves the Day. And what happened was I wasn't cool enough to hang out with them, but they downloaded it. Napster had come out, and they downloaded it on my computer, so I ended up finding it anyway. And it was at the perfect time, because I didn't really identify with, like, Limp Bizkit and mm-hmm. I guess that next wave of, you know, what was going on in alternative radio. And so I got really into, you know, I hadn't quite even heard the term emo yet at that point. It was something, you know, I don't know what we were calling it, but I kind of identified that as the new alternative, you know. And mm-hmm. With not too long after alternative radio started to kind of figure it out, with, like, I remember seeing Thursday at a Q101 Jamboree,
mm-hmm.
Dashboard Confessional at maybe the same Jamboree or the year after. I mean, I was at all those Q101 events. I think it was like the Strokes played, Zwan played, and Thursday played on like a side stage.
The tides were turning.
Like Edema or like something, you know, Crazy Town.
Not that crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. But not too long after that, you know, I started going to the Fireside. I was always there. And then Bill Beckett, the singer of Academy, he started like a Dashboard ripoff. And he started playing like local VFWs under, it was called Remember Maine. And it was so emo. And he played a show at a place called Back to the Office in Hoffman Estates. And when the show was over, everyone was kind of hanging out, mostly underage kids, drinking soda pops and talking about, you know, Woodfield Mall and
whatever you do as a kid in the suburbs,
in the suburbs, you know, and this kind of squirrely, like, nerdy kid with like the first time I'd ever seen a brimmed beanie on somebody, which was like, it kind of became a trend because of him, was this guy going by the name of Patrick Fallout. And the show was over, but he had an acoustic guitar and he sang Allison by Elvis Costello and What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. And he could sing. And nobody else there could really sing.
So him out there playing those two songs on acoustic guitar, he got laid that night.
Very doubtful. not because the opportunity wasn't there, but because he probably didn't see the opportunity. very doubtful. But who knows? Maybe there was something going on I didn't know. But I couldn't believe he could sing. And I said, who is that? They said, that's Patrick Fallout from Fallout Boy. And so I went up and struck a conversation. And we just became fast friends. And then from that point, I started kind of following their local circuit at these skate parks. Real divey. The kind of venues where the drummer's like in a plastic cage. You know, they had to separate them. Jinx Pack, much the same. Starstruck, this kind of like weird, more like outer city suburb scene at first. Plain White Tees were kind of on the peripheral of that. But that wasn't really my scene. My scene was the Arlington Heights VFW that came after where I was at. Back to the Office got shut down for serving beer to underage kids. So we moved over to the Knights of Columbus, where I think the era that had just passed was like Rise Against and a more hardcore era. Yeah. And Patrick Fallout was in a band called Patterson, which was a heavier band. Pete Wentz was in Arma Angelus that Tim from Rise Against was also in. So that scene had sort of overlapped. 88 Fingers Louie, that sort of different local niche that we were definitely never a part of. But we came in, it was 504 Plan, August premiere. Much the same, Jinx Pack kind of crossed into that. A band called Knockout, who was on Fearless Records, who really looked like they were primed to be like the new kings of pop punk. Damar from that band went on to be in Plain White Tees. And then Fall Out Boy was maybe like first of six on the bill, you know, and they started to like climb that over time. And they came out with an EP that Sean O'Keefe produced, or not even an EP, it was a three-song demo. And that sort of blew the lid off of the local scene, and those three songs were on their first album, Take This to Your Grave, and that was kind of it. I knew when that demo came out that they were better, and that if I wanted to get into music, I should position myself with them. And I went to Kinko's, made a bunch of flyers of all their shows. I burned copies of their CD to give to everyone at my school. And then the shows at Knights of Columbus started filling up with like at least 100 people from Barrington High School were turning out at those, because
those are some fast times.
And it also, yeah, absolutely, and it positioned me well as like this trendsetter where I all of a sudden was the guy at school who people would go to, what are the bands? And I'd say, here's, you know.
That's awesome. And, you're a curator.
I kind of wanted to start a label. But then what happened was my father passed away right after my 15th birthday. And a show in Downers Grove in a church basement, Rise Against and Fall Out Boy played. I went to the show instead of my father's funeral. Just because it would have been a travel to the Virgin Islands for my father's funeral. And there was just some hard feelings, and I ended up wanting to go to that show. I think it felt more like my community. And Pete said, well, what do you really want to do with your life? And I said, I want to play bass in a band. And he knew Mike Carden, who had auditioned to be the fifth Fall Out Boy, and he was too young. His parents said he couldn't go on tour, and so Patrick started playing guitar instead, and they stayed a four piece. But that was kind of it, and he introduced Bill and I to Mike Carden, and that's where the Academy has began.
You mentioned your lead singer.
Yep.
Can I also call him Bill?
Yep, that's what I call him.
Well, I know, but I've only known him as William. I didn't know if I could.
I forget where that came. I think when the liner notes for the album were being made, you know, it was like, I think I'll go by William. It's more of a writer's name.
Okay,
very William nice. Beckett does have like, it does have a very, you know, kind of aristocratic English poet's
it
name
does,
or something, you know.
Well, even Billy Corgan became William Patrick Corgan after
yeah,
a while.
Yeah, and I definitely prefer Billy Corgan.
100%.
And I prefer Bill Beckett, too, so.
Well, let's talk about him for just a second.
Yep.
Obviously, for a lot of people, it's that voice and those lyrics that pulled them into the band. Talk to me about him as your lead singer.
Yeah, I mean, he was the first guy I ever knew that could write a song. He played in that band with my brother. He was the drummer. And one day, he picked up my bass and down in the basement, and he had a song. And, you know, if I played it for you now, you know, it probably wouldn't make an album, you know. But for a 16, 17-year-old kid in the burbs, like, I could see potential. And that was really where I kind of started to see Elaine as somebody marginally talented. I was like, I can kind of, if I follow this guy, I might get somewhere, you know? And that was true. You know, meeting him changed my life. When I got to high school, on the first day of school, we both showed up wearing Saves the Day t-shirts. And he was a junior, I was a freshman. And I don't think he liked that I was kind of copying his style. And there was this girl, I guess she had the hots for him, and I said, he's a good buddy of mine. And a few days later, she goes, you know, I talked to him. I said, are you friends with Adam Siska? And he said, no, I'm friends with his brother. So apparently he shot that down real quick. But, you know, throughout that year, you know, actually I remember my first conversation with him where we really started to become friends was on 9/11. They had kind of pulled us out of classes, and we were, it was like our physical education, maybe third period or something. Everything had just gone down. And I remember like sitting on the bleachers out there, and while like the world was falling apart, we were just kind of talking about like Alkaline Trio or Reggie and the Full Effect or some obscure band, you know, that we were, and from that day forward, we just became friends. So 9/11 was in my mind, which ironically, when the Academy was forming, one of our first practices was, there was a TV on in the background, and it was the night that Operation Iraqi Freedom began. So it was kind of, you know, that was the era that we were kind of, I guess, getting going in music, you know, was the Bush years. So
that's indelible stuff.
Yeah. It's weird how those things stay out in my memory,
yeah.
You know, but it felt significant. So.
So this summer, you're opening for Fall Out Boy at Wrigley Field. That's pretty cool.
It is.
That's a make sure the whole family is there kind of thing.
Yep. They're definitely making sure that I'll get them sorted out. They're counting on it.
I bet they are.
Yeah, my stepdad, he goes, I can't wait to see what backstage at Wrigley Field looks like.
Oh, I bet you can wait for that.
And I was like, yeah. With COVID protocol, I'm not so sure we're going to be able to accommodate, Fall Out Boy is on tour, and we want to make sure that we don't get them sick by bringing, our whole family back there. So, we can get sick and not have to worry about missing shows, but for them, it would be a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So in summary, if I can summarize what we talked about, this is fun for you. You're inspired to be around each other. Where this goes from here, don't know, but for right now, it's a hell of a lot of fun.
It's so much fun. I mean, like I said, I feel like we're playing better than ever. We're playing as a six-piece for the first time. What happened when we announced our reunion, or when we booked Riot Fest, I reached out to Ian to play guitar. Mike reached out to Jamie to play guitar. Then we got on the phone with each other, and we kind of realized we had both invited.
It's like a sitcom.
And so we were like, oh, we got room for both of them. And it's pretty cool because, Mike doesn't play a lot of guitar since the band broke up, even though he was kind of like the chief or co-writer, at least, of the songs. And now he just kind of rings out the dirty chords and fills in that low end. And we have these two hired guns who really just learned the songs inside and out. And it's so much fun, and we've kind of learned that like little amps sound better. we watched a bunch of videos of like Keith Richards talking about his rig, and back in the day I think we used to love to have these like huge back sure. lines and really look like we were the biggest band in the world, a big wall of sound. But now we've found some of these small combo amps can just bring a lot of power, and I'm really excited to just get out and play Wrigley Field. I joined Fall Out Boy on a song there in, I guess that was 2018. I think it was their first time playing Wrigley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things that when you're up there, I remember looking out at the bleachers and saying, I'll probably never be back here, And I know that I'm wearing a Sox hat, but I don't care what anyone says. I love both teams here in the city.
I don't know why that's not okay to say.
Yeah, I don't see them as natural rivals. The Cardinals, Cleveland, get out of town, but Cubs and Sox, I don't like going to the crosstown game because I don't have a vested interest. For me, it's where are they in the standings? Who needs a win more? My whole thing is I want to see the crosstown World Series, so I'm always for both teams. And we'll see who I'm for when that day comes.
But. Right, exactly. The good news is I think we have some time.
Yeah. Well, it's this coming season.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So, summer, the Academy is in Chicago at Wrigley Field with Fall Out Boy. Holy shit, what a show.
Yeah. And the fact that Alkaline Trio is playing is just as if it couldn't be any cooler, And,
right.
For us, I saw Matt Skiba at Woodfield Mall once by the food court, and I've actually never met him. I actually saw him again at the Key Club in LA at a Steel Panther show. He seemed to be having a really good time, but I always played in a band that I didn't think was cool enough to go up and say, hey, I play in this band, because I kind of always thought Matt Skiba would probably be like, that's cool.
I've only met him twice, and they're both interview situations. Yeah. I interviewed him once when I was on Q101 in like 2006, a long time ago. And then when I was at WKQX a few years ago, Trio came in and I did an interview with them. Super great.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I did a DJ thing for Riot Fest alongside Derek, the drummer for Alkaline Trio. And it turned out that we had been neighbors for years in Vermont, but never
That's
met each
crazy.
Other. Yeah, like a small town too, where like on our street it was like all these guys from bands that
What are the odds?
Yeah, it was interesting.
Is the syrup really better there?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, I mean, I got into like different grades.
Oh my, okay.
Yeah, so like the dark amber syrups and stuff. Yeah, actually, I learned a little bit about it while I was up there.
It's like craft brewery.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like that with syrup. But it turns out my wife has been teaching Dan Andriano from Alkaline Trio's sister yoga for like the last 10 years. She comes in, she goes, we announce Wrigley. She goes, do you know Andriana or something from Alkaline Trio? I'm like, yeah, Dan Andriano from Slapstick and Tuesday, you know, some like hugely influential on us, you know, so really cool. And one band I do want to mention, we covered a Material Issue song at Riot Fest this year, and they just had a new documentary come out.
I'm anxious to see that.
Yeah, me too. And I somebody had reached out, the director, who's actually he filmed some of our stuff, some B-roll at Riot Fest. He did the Material Issue movie, and they called and asked if I would be on the like Q&A panel at the premiere. And it just so happened that it was my wife's birthday, and we went on vacation to Florida, and I was so bummed to not be there for it, because hugely influential band, not so much for the Academy as when we were coming up, mm-hmm. but in the years since, a band that I got really into, and you know, their story is definitely unique from ours. Obviously, you know, Jim's passing is just terrible, you know, mm-hmm. but I think there's some parallels too for sort of like this. There was a moment where we were going to be the next biggest band in the world, and we weren't. But a lot of people still love the band. You know, I love the fact that we're some people's favorite band. You know, we don't necessarily have to be a household name. We have our fans, and that means the world to us. So I just wanted to give Material Issue a shout out.
Glad you did.
Yeah.
Great band, great songs. I always appreciated back in the day how they always swung for the fences. Back in the early to mid-90s, where it wasn't cool to want to be successful,
yeah.
they went into every room they played and took it over like they were playing arenas and stadiums. Like, unapologetically, they were an arena rock band playing at Metro or
Thurston's Abbey Pub or something. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think they just, like, you know, living on this side of town specifically, like, you know, heading northwest out of the city, I think there's, like, no better band that captures that sound of Avondale, just, like, along Milwaukee Avenue, mm-hmm. you know, and they're just, like, unsung heroes, and Mike from Material Issue came out to see us play at Riot Fest.
It's a great drummer.
And to play the very first lie in front of, you know, I don't know exactly how many people were there, but it was a sizable crowd, and to get to play that song, I felt like honored Jim in a really cool way that I was really proud to be a part of. So,
well, this has been long overdue. I'm really glad we did this.
No, I couldn't be happier. Like I said, you know, my launch pad to rock music was listening to you on Q101. Yeah,
that's crazy to me.
I texted my buddy Harrison Hickok from I met on the playground in the third grade, and I said, I'm going to meet with James Van Osdell. And I was saying to my wife earlier, I took my wife and my daughter to the Shedd Aquarium today, and I found out that we can get, you know, I probably shouldn't tell everyone this, but you can go to the library here and get free museum passes. We just found this out this morning. Had a great day there for free.
Because the aquarium's expensive.
Extremely. Everything's expensive.
Yeah, fair.
Everything's so expensive except these dumplings, which I'm going to take a bite of here.
Please. So you're talking to your wife.
I was saying, you know, if you told me 20 years ago that I'd be walking over from my house in Chicago after taking my daughter and wife to the Shedd Aquarium to go do an interview with James Van Osdell, I'd be pretty happy with the way things turned out. So,
pretty cool. That makes me happy to hear. And
absolutely.
I'm really thrilled we did this.
Couldn't be happier. And let's do it again. You know, when the band comes to town, we'd love to get a full band interview too.
Yes. So. Yes. That would be cool if we all got in the same space.
I would love it. Yeah. And we tend to not really do interviews, but, you know,
we don't even need to talk about music. Yeah. We covered, check. We talked about the music now. We can just fuck around and talk about other people's music if you want.
Yeah. I mean, we barely scratched the surface. So, you know, I definitely, I could talk all night.
I love it. All right. Finish your dumpling. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. The Academy is. They're back for now, and that's pretty fucking great.
One last tidbit. Twisted Five. Stephen Jenkins comes on stage. He says, am I allowed to cuss?
Yeah, I just did.
All right, quiet. I don't even notice these things. He goes, third eye blind is a fucking animal. And if any Academias fans are watching this, know this is something that Bill Beckett, has said at every Academias show since like 2005.
That's amazing.
I told him to say it.
That's amazing.
And I picked it off of Twisted Five. Stephen Jenkins, he said some even more vulgar stuff that I won't even say on here about what Semi-Charmed Life is about, which blew my fifth grade.
Oh, yeah, once you realize what that song's about.
It was crazy.
You can't believe it was as big of a hit as it was.
But he goes, third eye blind is a fucking animal. He throws his tambourine in the air. He's, like, dancing everywhere. It was like I had never seen Mick Jagger at that point, and, you know, this was the most, like, swagger I had ever seen.
Oh, he has lots of swagger for days.
And just wanted to mention, because even if you watch footage from this last Riot Fest, I told Bill before the show, because we played at the same time as Nine Inch Nails, mm-hmm. He, for the first time ever, altered the Academy as a fucking animal. And he said, Nine Inch Nails are over there, and they want to fuck you like an animal. The Academy is a fucking animal.
That's so amazing.
But that's the last tidbit for you.
All right. We're done. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Thank you.